Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 21st, 2004. Today's session number is THM 2004-01. Today's speakers are Michael and Susan Thomas. And the lesson for today is Middle East, especially Israel and Palestine, stones. Let's listen in.
Welcome to the class that deals with the geology of the Eastern Cascades. Now, actually, there's a 10-point bonus for anyone that can identify where this rock is.
Martin Ridge.
Okay, 10 points, Lauren Johnson.
Is it really?
Collect afterwards. We're going to be talking about stones today. We are, in fact, gathered around a pile of stones that have been cemented together. Let me just introduce myself. I'm Michael Thomas, and my wife Susan Thomas and I shared a ministry in Jerusalem. We were missionaries for the Division for Global Mission of the ELCA, and we were there from 1998 to, I was there till 2003, and Susan left in 2002. That's a complicated story, and we'll talk about that. What we're going to do, first of all, is just ask how many of you have been to the Middle East, wherever in the Middle East? Okay. So at least a good, it looks like a third, quarter to a third. And how many have been to Jerusalem? Okay, approximately the same group. Okay, we are going to imagine, when I came back along with Susan, we worked with our global mission. Now, it's called a team. I think it does the same work a committee does, but it's called a team of the New England Synod. And we helped plan a Synod trip along with Southeast Michigan this past May to the Holy Land. And I worked very actively on helping to prepare the itinerary. And then I met with the group in Jerusalem. I was there for another meeting. And so I got a sense of what it was like while we served in Jerusalem to be a member of a delegation or a tour group, what it was like to come back, and how you incorporate that experience. And incorporate's really the right word. How do you take that experience in bodily? And so you are a kind of tour group, a kind of delegation, a kind of accompaniment group to the Middle East, to the Holy Land. And we are going to bombard you with images. I hope not too many images this week, but it's going to be similar. They're going to be emblematic images. And I hope it's similar to what a person might experience visiting the Holy Land. You come back, you've just gotten over your jet lag and you're ready to come back to the United States or Canada or wherever you live. And you have this welter of images, and as you begin to fall asleep, you can see images of stones, images of walls, images of water, images of bread, images of garden from your time in the Holy Land. And that's what we're going to, that's the kind of trajectory that we're going to follow this week. Today, we are not going to have time for questions. Tomorrow, we're going to have somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes of time, and we're going to try to alternate so that there is ample time. So we're going to begin today talking about stones. Tomorrow we're going to talk about water and something called the matrix of control. Wednesday we're going to talk about walls. Thursday we're going to talk about bread, and bread in many different facets. Friday we have off, everybody has a breather. And then Saturday we conclude with a talk about gardens and an image of garden, thinking back to Genesis, of the tree of knowledge and revelation, the tree of life and that connecting arc. So we look forward to this week. There will be a lot of images. We will try to have time to talk, and we will certainly offer many resources. So we're going to begin just where we are right now at Holden, in the Cascades, and thinking about contact, what you see out of your window when you wake up and the morning light comes to your eyes. What do you see? And we're going to try to give you a sense of what many Palestinians and Israelis see.
I would like, just before you go further, though, we served a church, the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer, in the Old City of Jerusalem. We served specifically the English-speaking international congregation there, but we worked very closely with Bishop Muneeb Younan of the ELCJ and with the Palestinian Lutherans in the area as well. And so our experience was one that was, we certainly were foreigners and involved with the international community there, but we also had the privilege of particularly getting to know the Palestinian Christians, especially, and also some of the Israeli Jewish people there. So just so that you understand what we were doing there.
So let's begin. Whoops, we went too far. We begin with stones in the Negev. Stones are everywhere in the Holy Land. The first thing, we have three boys, the first things they did when we arrived in Jerusalem in the summer of 1998 was get out of our van and run across the street to where there was an abandoned, burnt-out auto. And a couple of other, some neighborhood kids soon came out to see who these new kids on the block were. And the first thing that they did together was throw stones at the burnt-out auto. And so stones are everywhere.
We turn off the lights, is that all right?
Sure, sure, that will help.
Does it focus a little bit sharper?
No, unfortunately it doesn't. Focus.
Yeah, we tried to
work with it, but this is it.
We thought we were going to have another kind of connector to improve the quality of the image. This, of course, is the Western Wall, or the Kotel in Hebrew, and it's the holiest site in Judaism. It's on the edge, of course, of the Temple Mount, where the temple was located, and for Muslims today, it's called the Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary.
It's really a stone city. The Jerusalem is just a stone city in most ways. Very, all of the building material is basically stone.
And it does snow in Jerusalem, and so that's always a welcome respite from the usual tensions where you can get out and throw snowballs instead of rocks, and you can slide around.
Also, the Dome of the Rock, which is pictured here, is built over a rock, and to have the holy sites in the land very much associated with rock is a reality there. The rock there is the rock that Muhammad stepped upon as he had his night journey to Jerusalem. And it is right in the center. It's very striking.
And I'm going to use my pre-modern pointers. This is the only time I'll use it. So this is the Church of the Redeemer. Built in the late 19th century, completed in 1898, and this is the church that we served in. At that church, there are four language group congregations. There, of course, is the Palestinian congregation speaking Arabic. There is the German congregation speaking German. There's even a small Danish congregation, mostly of Danish volunteers. And then there is the English-speaking congregation, where there are many people, of course, from North America, but also Europe and Australia, New Zealand, and Africa. Cool. Whoops. Well, and adjacent to the Church of the Redeemer is the Church of the Holy, known by Western Christians as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and by Orthodox Christians or Eastern Christians known as the Church of the Resurrection. This is the parvis or the porch that leads you into the church. And stones, and this is an ancient column adjacent to a modern bomb disposal device of some sort in that part of the entry area into the church. And this is on the frame of the door as you come into the church. Everywhere carved into stone from actually before, long before the Crusader times, there's actually a boat painted in the 4th century in part of the church. Everywhere there's incisions and carvings to sort of say, I was here, I marked this journey. And so there are many crosses. This is a Franken cross, and many people have left reminders of their journey to Jerusalem to this church. Pilgrimage began to this church in the 4th century. It was built and dedicated in 326. And if you come early enough in the morning, or often any time during the day, you have a member of the Nuseva clan, a Muslim family, that are entrusted with the keys to the church. So that because of the various groups, various Christian churches that have access, that have claims to this church, find it easier to trust a Muslim to open the door and to close the door at night than another Christian. And as you come into the church, you have the stone of anointing. And here, this was the Greek Orthodox patriarch, Timaeus, who has come on his name, Saint's Name Day. And so there's a large group. I'm sorry for the quality.
The monk is kissing.
Yeah. And as you come in, it's very confusing. It's not the museum, the Metropolitan Museum. There are not good signage to show you where to go. You have to sort of figure out. And you go up these stairs that ascend to Golgotha. And looking down from those stairs, you can see where those hanging lights are, is where the stone of anointing is.
What is the stone of anointing?
It's the area that is revered for after Jesus' crucifixion, where his body was placed prior to being brought to the tomb.
And so there are sort of two Golgothas. There's the Orthodox side. This is on the Orthodox side. Do you want to point out something?
Yeah, I think the main thing I would want to point out here is that again, you know, you have another major holy site, which is on stones, and the stone is very important. Here you have clear plastic or glass, I guess, strong glass windows onto the rock of Golgotha. This is a relatively recent thing in the church that has been done to acknowledge that this is this holy site with the stone of it, and so the chance to actually see it. Even though it's covered, is important.
So Golgotha is the site where Jesus was crucified, and it's immediately outside the city walls in the 1st century and adjacent to a rock quarry. And you come down the stairs and you wander around and you come to what's called the edicule, the tomb that has been built over the grave area, the hollowed out area from the rock that the body of Jesus was laid in. And I call this my angel picture because the lighting is not very good. In some ways, the image is more glorious than when you get there, it can be dark. There were these girls dressed in white, moving, and they looked like angels. And let me say something that in 2000, the millennial year, you would have to line up for a long time outside the edicule to be able to go in, and you wouldn't have an opportunity really to kneel. I don't know if you can see, there's a woman's hands by the candles praying. You would not have that opportunity. And we had a couple of scholars in the congregation that year who were doing sabbatical, and the woman was sort of a edicule nut. Now, there are edicules built, the replicas of this
this little house,
all over Europe. And so she's visited many of them and researched them. And her dream in her sabbatical year in Jerusalem was to spend the night, which you can do, in the church, and to be able to spend much time in prayer at this edicule, at the tomb. There's a marble slab actually on top of the rock. So that's what the woman's hands are resting on. And in the entire year that she was there, she was never once alone in this. In 2002, 2003, it was easy to come in. Her husband came and visited one time, and we just sauntered over after worship. We're just 50 yards from that site, 40 yards, and sauntered over, and there was no one there. We just walked in. And even at this church, though, there are barriers. This is an old entrance off Christian Quarter Road into the church that was blocked up sometime in the 11th century. Now we've suddenly left Jerusalem, and it's not unusual if you're a tourist, if you're a part of a delegation, to suddenly find yourself somewhere else and you're trying to remember where you were an hour ago. But now we're down just a few miles from the Dead Sea. We're one day's walk from Jerusalem at a place called Nabi Musa, the prophet Moses, where there's some tradition that he was buried on the western side of the Jordan. Muslims stay at this place, at this holy place, as they walk towards Mecca, a two-week journey by foot. And more, another scene from the desert, this time in southern Israel. And some of the, there were monastics everywhere in the desert, everywhere. In the Dead Sea area, some think that there were up to 5,000 men and women living as desert hermits.
So obviously this was a women's convent, and we have people from the ELCA who formed the convent standing there.
Barbara Rossing doing pre-rapture research.
Joanne Chadwick of the women's women's desk, and Sandra Holloway, also as part of DGM, and myself. But people would come, of course, as you know, people would come to see all the stones of the holy sites and the buildings, the stones and stones. And then we are in Galilee area, and this is in the church that marks the place where Jesus, the miracle of the loaves and the fishes. And this famous mosaic is also, of course, made of little stones.
No extra points will be given for the correct answer, but just think about why are there four loaves and not five? Because there were five loaves in the story. In the story.
Jesus is the
fifth is on the altar.
They never have room.
I heard a correct answer floating out there, but just think about it. And that was up on the Galilee. We're going to, in the 5 days we have together, we're going to come back, we're going to come in and out, so we will have other pictures from the Galilee. We're back in the old city of Jerusalem. It's 6 a.m. on Good Friday. And the Anglicans and the Lutherans have gathered for a joint Via Dolorosa procession in German, Arabic, and English.
And they're going up the hard, stony steps of the...
And it's not as if it's a holy day. All the metal shutters and gates are opening and closing. You hear the garbage trucks. The business day has begun. And something I was very happy about this time is that for the first time in our experience, and probably the first time ever, a girl was asked to carry and hold the cross. And then we can't go in because of the conflict between churches. We'll talk a little bit about the church. We'll talk later about the churches, but because of the distrust and the understanding of how the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and the Church of the Resurrection, how they admit various groups, we as Protestants are not able to enter into that church to do the stations, the 14 stations of the cross.
To officially have worship there. We can certainly go in there, but to officially...
But not as a procession. The Anglicans, though, do have a kind of broom closet upstairs with permission. And let me just mention the Anglicans. We have Bishop Riad in the purple, and next to him, Bishop, who's Anglican, essentially he's from Nazareth, and Bishop Muneeb Yunnan of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan. We'll talk about why it has that name at another point. And then another Palestinian Anglican priest adjacent to him. And then it really concludes at the Church of the Redeemer, and we have worship there. And this is where the English-speaking congregation, as well as the Danish-speaking congregation, meet for worship. And one of the reasons that we showed this wasn't just simply to show you a picture of the church, but also to note that even here in this refectory built in the 13th century, there's a block, you can see there's a block door just behind the left portion of the altar.
That became significant for us as more and more of the area became constricted and filled with stone.
And this is our neighborhood. Children in our neighborhood.
We were in the Resurrection neighborhood in our church life, and so now we move now to our
and we live on the Mount of Olives
neighborhood.
Sheep. Are those sheep?
Yeah.
Yeah. We would see sheep and camels. And then shortly after the Intifada, the uprising, or in Arabic, I understand that the word means sort of shaking off, began in October, or very end of September 2000, people were killed, and these people were considered martyrs, and these are not, and so even within a month, even within a week or two of the beginning of the Second Intifada, people had placed in our neighborhood pictures of people that have died, most of them shot by Israelis at various gatherings where stones were thrown. And this is the extended family of our landlord and our neighbors. And
we lived in a Muslim neighborhood, one of the interesting things that happened over the course of the time we were there, this is the wife of the people who lived in the same building with us, and over the course of time she began to become more pious and put on the hajib regularly.
And do the prayers. We would see her and her neighbors gather with other women for prayers.
Her mother-in-law was this delightful woman who always wore the scarf, but when we said we would like to take a picture of them, she disappeared for a while and she came out again without the scarf on, and I have no idea why she did that for us, but it was really,
it was important to her. And guess who's the head of the family here?
Her.
Yes. We're moving now kind of into the living stones aspect of this. We have throughout the time that people were coming to the Holy Land to see these stones of the holy sites and so on. The Christians there in particular wanted tourists to remember that there were living stones there, and those are the people who made the land.
Mm-hmm.
day, some of the everyday life, everyday
markets. We're in West Jerusalem now on Ben Yehuda, which is a pedestrian mall, and a place where there have been major bombings in the past 3 years. We're here on a Sabbath, so it's not quite as busy as it normally is.
The people try to maintain their life. This is again West Jerusalem, and you see the soldier with the rifle guarding things. And then you see the closed. This is one of the tourist streets in the old city of Jerusalem. And as things became more violent and the tourists stopped coming, the economy, of course, has suffered tremendously. And so you see all these closed shops and their shopkeepers sitting outside reading and playing backgammon and drinking tea. This is another market area.
This is actually in Israel. Tekarim, and the wall of separation or the barrier fence is back in the towards the back, just before those white buildings. There's a watchtower on the far right that you can just possibly see. And before this picture was taken, a week before, there had been something like 38 market stalls, similar to the one here on the left. And those were all destroyed because they were deemed to be to interfere with security issues. And
so was it clear? This is an Israeli Arab market. So it's a market of people who live in Israel but who are Arab.
So orders had come to evacuate the market. It hadn't been evacuated, and then their bulldozers just came and bulldozed it down. Here we have, this is a priest I met in Nablus, and I really appreciated his dignity as he talked about his parish ministry.
Nablus is in the West Bank, so we're moving into some of the other areas.
Yeah, Nablus is almost at the far northern edge of the West Bank. And Samir, who maybe some of you who've been to Jerusalem have bought falafels from him on Christian Quarter Road. He's a member, a lifelong Lutheran. There are Lutherans. We want to really make that, emphasize that point, and we'll do that during the course of the week. He's also a follower, has great interest in that healer. What's his name, Barbara, that we were talking about?
Benny Hinn.
Yeah, Benny Hinn. And often, so behind, there's a television up there, and he often has Benny Hinn videos playing. And this is a KLM office that in East Jerusalem, in Palestinian Jerusalem, and it closed down. I left Israel. I moved out of Israel on June 23rd, 2003, and this man, the director of the office, the manager of the office, also moved out of Jerusalem to go to California. He had had it, and this is the story that you will hear over and over again. And what we witnessed really on a daily basis was the humiliation of Palestinians. He had had it going through checkpoint after checkpoint to go to work. He had had it with having his children watch seeing him humiliated by the soldiers at checkpoints. And he decided, I'm going to go to California, sunny California. I have a green card. My brother is a U.S. citizen. He manufactures ATM machines. He's very successful. And I will simply become an executive in his company. And so there's one less Christian Palestinian and in Jerusalem on that
and
day.
And no employment for the people that
were
working.
Yeah, for the when we came, there were six people in his office. And when I left, there were two. And Rima, who is an accountant and works at World Vision, and a good friend in the Syrian Orthodox Christian. And Eli.
Eli is a delightful single young man. He's wearing a a T-shirt from the Swedish Theological Institute. He's an Austrian
Christian. And he had just been in Sweden.
He's very talented, very smart, and unemployed. Cannot find work and hasn't been able to work for at least two years.
And I saw him, just coincidentally, in West Jerusalem on Ben Yehuda Street. And he lives with an Israeli. And so he's a crossover person. He crosses over very well, but he knows some of the risks that he takes. He speaks fluent Hebrew, Arabic, English, and pretty good German. This is Yasser Barakat, who is close by the Redeemer Church, who sells wonderful rugs and furniture and artwork, and it's always a delight to visit his children. Are back now, or in Jordan actually, and they were educated at Brigham Young University at no cost to him. And Abu George, the doorkeeper, an important person, every single Sunday he would say, welcome Pastor Thomas, and I indeed felt welcomed every Sunday. And this is Yassid Said, an Anglican priest. He'll be studying for his doctorate at Cambridge this fall. And so our son is hoping to link up with him. And he's the person that brought the girl in to carry the cross. Bethlehem, Manger Square, a protest organized by Palestinians against violence, both violence from Palestinian from the Palestinian side and from the Israeli side, but holding up probably our main thesis point that the occupation is the problem. And we'll talk about that during the week. And a dear friend holding a sign, I don't know if you can see it, for God so loved the world. It's a picture of Jesus in the shape of the map of Iraq, of hundreds of pictures formed of individuals forming that photograph at another protest. We had weekly vigils in Bethlehem. We'll hear more about the Zugbe family. And church in Nablus, a visit to try to get a sense of what local Christianity was like in the West Bank. And we'll talk a little bit about an organization called Sabil, which is the Palestinian Center for Liberation Theology, founded and led by an Anglican priest, Naeem Atik, who is the man with the collar. And again, Bishop Muneeb, following one of our worship services, talking with a member of our congregation who was a diplomat. And now we go to Talit Takumi. And most of you know what that means, where that appears in the Bible.
No. Okay. It's the story of the daughter of Jairus, and who has died, and Jesus is brought, and Jesus says to her, Talit Takumi, little girl, arise, daughter, arise. And she stands up.
So we're at a graduation. This is in 2002.
So this is a school that is
Or 2003. Graduation 2003.
This is and a what's really school that has been formed for, started out for girls and became co-ed.
And then what's really wonderful is in Arabic here, it says Palestini Kumi. So I've been told. I don't read Arabic.
Oh.
And so Palestinians arise. And schools are a very important part of ELCJ's mission. And of course, you can't have a graduation without a choir. And neither can you have a graduation without parents that are proud. These kids went through a lot. We just attended the 8th grade. It wasn't really a graduation, but an acknowledgement that our 8th grader had finished middle school. And so part of the graduation ceremony was various members of the class getting up and saying, We were the class that saw September 11. We were this and we were that. And likewise, the same thing could be said for the class that graduated at Talitha Kumi. They have endured the occupation all their whole lives, and their whole parents' lives in some cases. And they've also endured closure and the inability to get to school. And here they have finally graduated.
You can see here that it's both a Christian and a Muslim population for the schools, and all the Lutheran schools are not only for Lutherans or for Christians, but they work at the relationship between the peoples.
They're roughly half and half, I understand.
Yeah, that's about right.
Enrollment.
Yeah.
And again, various people. This is Michael Unum, who happens to be the bishop of the brother, who's an engineer.
The brother of the bishop.
And maybe he functions as a chaplain to the bishop, too. I don't know. And his mother, Manib's mother, sitting to his left. And he is explaining to a group of people just how bad it's becoming. He lives in Jerusalem, but he knows Bethlehem very well. And he's talking about the plans for the wall that's going to go around Bethlehem, to close off Bethlehem from Jerusalem. And at this point, nothing had happened. This is in May 2003, other than some ditches and preliminary engineering sketches for the most part. We'll show you pictures later when we talk about walls, about what has happened. Delegations are important to remember the accompaniment which is the kind of image that the ELCA uses to describe its relationship with overseas churches. And so it was important for the presiding bishop, Mark Hansen, along with several other bishops, to come to the Holy Land, even for a very brief visit, to meet primarily with Lutheran, but also with other church leaders, and it goes almost without saying, with Israeli officials as well. And so this was one of the dinners. Now, for those of you, how many would describe yourself as low church, sort of coming out of... Well, you don't have to, you don't have to raise your hand. I have a lot of sympathy, a lot of empathy for a kind of low church piety, and in terms of understanding how Jesus walked in the land of his birth. And so in some ways, it's a little hard to see all this church hierarchy and all these church functionaries and bishops and patriarchs and His Eminence this and that and so on, and all the different wardrobes. Jerusalem, I should have really designed my own wardrobe in Jerusalem, because that's the one place where you can do it. But it's important. You cannot understand Jerusalem without understanding the particular context of the churches that make up the Christian community. And so it was very important for Mark Hansen to meet with the church leaders. And Manib, as a bishop of a rather small church — there are 13 historic churches — as a bishop of a small church, has enormous voice, far out of proportion to the numbers of Lutherans. There are 6 ELCJ congregations, and they have as members somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 members. But he is part of the traditional 13 churches, and we, the Lutherans and the Anglicans, got in just under the wire. And Mark Hansen met with David Rosen, who's an important Jewish thinker and rabbi. Again, Ben Yehuda, this is also on set.
This is also one of the areas that has had suicide bombings been hit, yes. And this is not one of the places that has been hit, is it?
No.
No, but there have been, as you know, small restaurants and so on that also been hit in West Jerusalem. Mm-hmm.
We're back to the Western Wall. This is the women's section. You can see, probably most of you know, that it's divided by gender. So you have a woman's side and a men's side.
It's a weary New England Synod delegation recently. They were just there in May, sitting on the hard rock of the area in front of the Western Wall.
We were waiting. I just coincidentally met them. I was out for a walk, and there they were. And so we were waiting for Shabbat to fall. Now, here's a wonderful story that Susan will tell.
Where this group is right now is, this is the New England Synod group. And in 2002, when Bethlehem was under siege, if you may recall, when the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem was, there were people that had holed up in the church for about 5 weeks, and the whole town was under siege, and during that time, the Christmas Lutheran Church, which Mitri Rahab is the pastor of, had gone through some had had a lot of destruction. They were in the middle of constructing a wonderful area that was going to be a huge convention center, international center area. And there was damage done to that, along with one of the school that they also ran, and so on. I came with a very small New England Synod delegation at that time. New England Synod is one of the companion synods for the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan. And a small delegation of three people came in the spring of 2002 and visited Mitri there while this area was still under siege. We got there with a lot of difficulty, crawling over earth berms to get into the city and trying to get a taxi that was going to take us then further into the church. And we finally got there, and it was very frightening, I think, for the people that were coming in.
There were Israeli tanks.
Israeli tanks and soldiers everywhere, and it was hard. So we came in, and Mitri had been ill. He and his family had been they'd been in their house for weeks because they'd not been allowed to go out. We brought them greetings. He showed us some of the damage that had been done at that point. And we saw things like, toilets that were supposed to be put into the various areas of the constructed building that had been shot up just to do that. The soldiers, the Israeli soldiers who had come to Bethlehem during that siege had taken that area over as a kind of headquarters. While we were there, then he said, "This area over here." We were walking through this thing, and it was under construction on the one hand, and under destruction on the other. That had been done during the siege, and so he was walking through, and at one and the same time, explaining all of this tragedy that had happened so far, and then in almost the same breath turned and said, "Over here is where, when the New England Synod comes to visit next year or the year after, this is where you'll have coffee," so on. "This is the place. They're having coffee."
having a meal
in the place that Mitri had indicated to us that was in this amazing situation. And so it's just a wonderful thing for me to see that. Another thing that he did at that time was when we were visiting, he scurried off to someplace in his apartment, and he came back with a stained glass ornament. And on our way out, we also picked up some of the glass, from some of the broken glass from the destruction that had been done there. But his message to us visitors, was that we have to make something of beauty and meaning out of this destruction that has been done. And the stained glass workshops that had begun there were already prepared to do this as a wonderful way of doing it. And they have developed this now, so they have a little brochure, and they have the glass art pieces that are made from the fragments of glass. And so now you can actually purchase these, and it's been a wonderful way of helping their economy of the local craft area. It's just a wonderful event.
And I'm going to actually skip over talking about Zugby, who's director of an organization called VAN. I hope to come back and talk another day. This is his family, and Elaine is his wife, and that's Tariq, one of his sons. He has four children. And Elaine, we met her first in May 1998. Susan and I, along with our oldest son, came to Jerusalem, and we went to Bethlehem to try to, since we're thinking about vocation here in this summer, as a summer theme, try to discern whether it was our calling, whether we were being summoned to come to Jerusalem to serve as pastors of the church. And it was Elaine and two others who met in Zugby's office who really, for me, really convinced me that this was where we were being called. I wasn't sure. We were living in Vienna, Austria, comfortable place, and it was Elaine who called out to us and summoned us. And so I've always been grateful. She lived in the U.S. This past year, and to try to give some order to her children's lives after having a year essentially being under curfew. And this is on the edge of Bethlehem and Jerusalem at a wall. Sometimes this is called the Golden Gate. It used to be just a doorway, and hundreds of Palestinians used to come through because you could bypass. There's a checkpoint adjacent to it. You could bypass that checkpoint by walking through. And this is taken just 2 weeks ago, and it's still open, but it's often closed. The Israelis have piled up stones, they've closed it, they've welded the door. It's Vatican land, and there's always sort of a running. The director of Tantura, which is an ecumenical research center owned by Notre Dame, always tried to keep that passageway open. And these are the bishops, our presiding bishop of the ELCA, but also the three bishops of the ELCJ, current bishop, of course, Medivh Yunan, and his predecessor, Bishop Nassar, on the left, I'm blanking out. This is the siesta hour.
The siesta hour. I'm blanking out also. Wonderful man.
Yeah.
Great bishop.
Okay, what was his
first
name?
First one, anyway.
Okay, I will. Chuck, do you remember?
No, okay. But another retired bishop.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And the incumbent is on the right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, this is the beginning of the Intifada. This is Ariel Sharon, then serving as a minister in the Israeli government, wanted to come up to the Temple Mount to show the right, that he had the right, the Jews had the right to come to the Temple Mount. And he came up with somewhere between 800 and 1,200 police to protect him. That was on a Thursday. The next day, Friday, after the Muslim prayers, some people, some of the Muslims Palestinians threw rocks down on Jews worshiping at the Western Wall. And of course, there was an immediate response by the Israelis, a storming of the Haram al-Sharif, and then a riot broke out. And so on that day, I had come home in the late morning. We were preparing for a retreat up in the Galilee, and we didn't know whether to go or not go. We decided to go, and it was an amazing experience, and you'll hear, we'll talk more about that. As we were coming back from the Galilee, so all of us are gathered in the congregation. It was, I think the retreat was entitled Prayer.
We had scheduled a retreat long before to talk about, you know, how we might prepare for what was to come, because these Camp David talks had been going on that summer.
And they had broken down,
everything was breaking down, and we wondered what we were going to be able to do. And so you see here these stones. We are on our way back.
And we've been routed through all sorts of different ways because of concerns. There was rioting by Arab Israelis. Palestinian Israelis, that is those who, Arabs who had Israeli citizenship. And so you can see, I don't know if you can see, but there are hundreds of rocks on the road, and I think 14 Palestinians were killed by Israelis.
And this was a very big day, a very important
event. So this is in Israel, this is not in the West Bank here.
So their own population was joining in this revolt. Very frightening to Israel.
And they killed their own citizens. And coming back, it seemed as if all of Israel was being rooted down one highway. So what would be a normal picture of happy people coming back from a retreat, I don't know if you can see, is there's no cars going in the other lane, and there's nothing but cars behind us. And it took about 9 hours to get home that day. And we moved at about 3 or 4 miles an hour for hours.
And one of the aspects of that day, which was very constant during the time that we were there, was the not knowing what was going to come next. You were sort of, things would ratchet up, and you wouldn't know, well, now what is this going to mean? You know, and how do we respond to that? How do we act now? Where can we go? Where can't we go?
This is at the Lutheran World Federation Hospital, Augusta, Victoria. We will talk more about the hospital and its situation. This is a wounded man in some disturbance the second Friday after the Intifada began. Shortly after the Intifada began, in Beit Sahor, which is a neighboring village to Bethlehem, some of the houses were bombed. And so Bishop Aniv has organized a group to come and witness firsthand what had happened at that village and in Beit Jala, which is on the other side of Bethlehem, which faces an Israeli settlement called Gilo. And again, the house has been burnt out on the inside. The Israelis claim that there was shooting coming from these houses towards a Israeli military camp, which is not in the far horizon, but midway, and the Palestinians are denying that there was any shooting from their houses. There may have been shooting from between the houses, but not from their houses. This is in Beit Jala, where a rocket was shot through someone's house, and the rocket was manufactured in the United States. It's this photograph. I took this photograph when we came up and saw it. And then we were shortly after that, I mean, in the same trip, we were interviewed essentially asking whether we could defend America's actions and providing the Israelis. But even in the midst of really difficult times, you find signs of hope. This is the German pastor of the congregation. His title is called Probst Ronecker, and Milad, the boy with the soccer ball, and his parents. And Milad had, which means child in Arabic, had very bad kidneys, and he was going to die. And somehow, he was the baby, in a sense, put on the doorstep of the German congregation. And they worked with the Palestinians, with Lutheran World Federation, with the Israelis, with the German government, to get him to Germany for a kidney transplant. And so in the midst of going to these places where there had been death in the immediate days before this picture was taken, shooting, and just instantly come upon Mihaly playing soccer, really lifted the spirits. This is Ramez, a pastor in Ramallah, a Lutheran pastor, and just briefly, in the context of the Intifada during one siege of Ramallah, he is describing how the Israeli soldiers, when they went through his school and church, he gave them the keys, but they said, no, you open up the door, and they pushed him in, so that if there was a Palestinian with a weapon who had and the intention of using it, he would be the person that would die. And this is called using human shields. And it's against the Geneva Conventions. And the Israelis have consistently denied that they have used it, but many Israeli human rights organizations have that well documented, that that has happened hundreds and hundreds of times. Hebron, a city south of Jerusalem. Curfew, a city of 130,000, of which there's a precinct that is about somewhere between 18,000 and 30,000 Palestinians and 400 or so Jewish residents. And they have been under curfew in the past for many, many months. And that means, that essentially means imprisonment in your house. It's not like a curfew for a teenager in a town that you have to be back in their home by 11.
Are they under curfew now?
No, it's been much more open. There's been much less tension there recently. Most of the tension is in Gaza. But this is a nice park built by an international organization on a Saturday morning, and no Palestinians can use it. No Palestinians can open up their market stalls, their stores. But Jews and internationals are free to walk around. Keep in mind this vine. We're going to come back to this vine and talk about what happened to this vine.
This vine coming up the wall.
Yeah. And then just 200 yards from where that picture was taken is the precincts surrounding this Jewish settlement and the Palestinians, where there are only Palestinian Muslims. And you can see normal, vibrant city life on a Saturday morning. This is probably the most dreaded and feared weapon in the Israeli arsenal. This is an armored bulldozer. It's made by Caterpillar, which has a very strong sense of social responsibility, but sees no problem in selling their bulldozers and other heavy earth-moving equipment to the Israelis. It's armor-plated in Israel, and the Israelis can wreak terrible misfortune using these bulldozers.
I think we're going to need to really flip through the rest of these. This is a lot of pictures of destruction in the town of Jenin, which was an area that received a lot.
Picking through the stones to find the belongings.
What happens also is that there are
we will talk tomorrow. We will have time to talk tomorrow. And here you have this woman is not persuaded that we have come to really be of consolation. This woman is weeping in Jenin. But notice the look on her daughter on the far right, a wonderful smile. And how these children are at ground zero, how they survive an intense conflict, a violent attack by the Israelis in response to Israeli soldiers dying is an amazing story.
One of the things here is the responses and the temptation to having stony hearts, really hard hearts.
This is just prior to the siege of Bethlehem. Hundreds of tanks and other military vehicles are lined up at the checkpoint next to Tantur, where we showed you Elaine going through the Golden Gate. Hundreds and hundreds of military vehicles. In West Jerusalem again, one minister in the Israeli cabinet urged all men who have licenses to bear firearms to carry their firearms, and so it's even more, you see even more firearms carried than in past years. Because of the fear. And yet on the other side you have Dalia Landau. We'll talk a little bit about her, a Jew who came from Bulgaria at the age of two, and we'll talk about her story. And Mary Jensen on the right, who served as a communicator, just having left her position in May to return to the United States after 2 years, did wonderful work working with the ELCJ and telling the story.
ELCA pastor.
Yes. Yes. And then this is the second to the last picture, organization called the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions, and we are here rebuilding a house that had been demolished twice before. And we'll talk about that. Israelis, Muslims, Christians, internationals working together, lifting the stones. And then the final picture is in the Church of the Redeemer, a compound that was built originally in the 12th century and then rebuilt in the late 20th century. A lot of the sculptural reliefs and inscriptions are simply mounted into the stone wall in the cloister. And this is what we call the Resurrection Corner. Now, I don't know if you can see it very well, but it's a forearm, and then you can see four fingers grasping the forearm at the wrist. And in Orthodox iconography, in the harrowing of hell, when Jesus descends to hell and then ascends, he reaches back, and no one, to use barbarous imagery, no one is left behind. And presumably in the iconography, what he's doing is he's reaching for our first parents, Adam and Eve, and pulling them, leaving no one behind. And so I wonder if this is in fact an icon, a sculptural relief of that iconography, if that motif is being used. We don't know for sure, but we call it the Resurrection Corner. So on Easter Vigil, this is where we preach from.
I would like to just say it's significant. I mean, it's so wonderful to work with these images because they can go so deep and broad. The fact that it's a fragment of the resurrection, a little glimpse of resurrection, and is in stone and is being revered to some extent is just significant in a setting where there's so much that is death-dealing. To have resurrection be really part, even a fragment of these stained glass ornaments of people's lives is so significant. We have materials here for you to take. We wanted to actually also mention the books that we had ordered for the bookstore. This is a well-known book by Mitri Rahab, the pastor.
There's only one copy. These are all copies that are in the bookstore. There's one left of that.
He wrote this several years ago. He has written another book that has just come out, which has wonderful stories. It's called Bethlehem Besieged. And it is stories of hope in times of trouble. And I found it a very fascinating and quick read in just the last day because it's just arrived. Would encourage you to do that. Water from the Rock was put together. Lutheran Voices from Palestine is also contains stories from Lutherans living in the land. We have a couple of things in here. Mitri Rahab, his sister Viola Rahab, others in the Lutheran Church there are in tell wonderful stories in there. Muneeb Younan, the pastor, the bishop of the ELCJ, has written a book called Witnessing for Peace, which is also in Jerusalem and in the world, connecting what's going on there to others. In Matilda was worked on by Fred Strickert from Iowa, from Wartburg in Iowa, in cooperation with Allison Jones Nassar, and it is a Bethlehem mother's diary. It also speaks about the time of the siege and life there now. Who are the Christians in the Middle East? There's a broad range of Christians, as you saw in the photographs. This was put together by Martin and Betty Bailey, very long interested Americans in the situation.
Part of our
Middle
congregation
East.
In Jerusalem.
And Whose Land, Whose Promise by Gary Berge. He is an evangelical who has really tried to work with the evangelical ideas of what should be happening in the Middle East and has really brought his communities to those questions.
And there's intersection with Barbara's talk in terms of Christian Zionism. Mm-hmm.
So all of those are excellent. We also have the Division of Global Mission has put out a brochure that has some resources about the ELCJ specifically. It's called Working for Peace in Israel and Palestine. Another similar but smaller brochure that was a little earlier. And then we have a wonderful resource among us. We have Chuck Lutz, who brought with him. You want to say something about Churches for Middle East Peace?
Churches for Middle East Peace is a U.S. coalition of about 20 Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox agencies based in Washington, D.C. It's our relationship to the federal government offices, including the ELCAs. And I do volunteer organizing in Minnesota for Churches for Middle East Peace, but they focus on U.S. policy in relation to the Holy Land. And we do some lobbying with members of Congress, we do a lot of education programs in the local churches, and then some of us also work to organize trips to the Holy Land. But there are some brochures, some newsletters from Churches for Middle East Peace, two rather recent newsletters that give an overview of how U.S. policy, for good or ill, mostly for ill, is impacting the realities of the Holy Land conflict. And so there are some brochures from CMEP there, and maybe I can say a little more tomorrow about how people can plug into that network.
Yeah.
Right. So tomorrow,
chances.
Get a good night's sleep. Tomorrow we talk for just a relatively short time about water, and then we have time for discussion. Thank you.